I was working in the lab late one night when my eyes beheld an eerie sight. For my monster from his slab began to rise, and suddenly, to my surprise,
he did the mash.
He did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
He did the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
He did the mash.
He did the monster mash. From my laboratory in the castle east to the master bedroom where the vampires feast, the ghouls all came from their humble abodes to catch a jolt from my electrodes.
They did the mash.
They did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
They did the mash.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome back to the Phantom Galaxy. I'm your host, Nathan Bartleball, and tonight I'm joined by...
Chris Durham, how you doing, guys?
And Seth, how are you?
Good evening, everybody. I'm doing great.
So, a couple things before we start. Again, that's Seth Domback with us. He has his own podcast, Going Deep with Seth Domback. You can find that over at Podbean, right, Seth?
Podbean and iTunes, yep.
Okay, are you up on iTunes now?
I finally got it working.
Yeah, I just had to send them something recently because our last couple episodes haven't gone up yet, so I haven't checked that out yet, but iTunes can be tricky sometimes. So, yeah, you can check his podcast over there, a philosophy podcast, talks pretty much everything under the sun, and we have, of course, co-host Chris Durham with me tonight, and we're going to talk about the Universal Monsters a little bit. We're also going to have a couple reviews for It Comes at Night, a new kind of independent horror film. And also The Mummy with Tom Cruise, which is the start of the Dark Universe.
Two very different sides we've got here. Indie movie and, like, full big budget classic, Hollywood blockbuster kind of thing.
Minus the classic part.
Well, yeah.
but they're hoping for classic. And we're going to also talk about the Universal Monsters. And when I say the Universal Monsters, I mean the old films. The movies from the 30s. The ones that these new movies are trying to cash in on a little bit. They both are and aren't, which is kind of weird. But and then kind of we'll talk about Universal and what they've been doing or they've been attempting to do with this whole Monsters universe. Seth, you were mentioning a few minutes ago, Van Helsing comes to mind, and Dracula Untold. Nothing but winning all the way up the up the line there. So and something I want to mention first, We've got the podcast up and running. We got about 5 episodes up for May, and we've got a lot of cool series that we're planning to start. Seth and I have the second episode of the Lovecraft series coming up next, and we're also going to do a Twin Peaks episode, and lots of different things. We want to start a cult movies kind of mini show within the podcast, and got a couple of different things that we're working on. One thing we'd ask for anyone who's listening is, if you get a chance, please go over to iTunes and just leave us a review there, because any review that's on iTunes, and preferably a positive review, it helps raise us in the ranking and just puts the show out there for more people to discover. And that's kind of our goal. It helps us, and it helps us be able to bring you guys better content. And we get good feedback, too. So please, if you get a chance, if you're listening to this, please consider going over to iTunes, just leaving us a review there. You can also join us on Twitter. We're Phantom Galaxy there. That's Phantom with an F, F-A-N-T-O-M, and then Galaxy. And we also have a Facebook page. And just, if you can give us some feedback, that would be great. So let's go ahead and get started. And I think what we'll do first... before we get jump into the Universal Monsters, is we'll start very quickly with the smaller film, It Comes at Night. And Chris, we saw this on Monday night. Seth, are you familiar with this movie at all?
Yeah, this is one I'm really looking forward to seeing. I have not seen it yet, but it does look good. I have a lot of trust in A24, so...
We were just saying that the other day. Yeah, like when it came, when A24
great
came
movies.
Up... They've done a very nice job of establishing a brand that I don't think they've sullied much, It's not Asylum.
Yeah. They produced The Witch, didn't they?
Yes.
I believe so,
Yeah, I thought that was one of the better horror movies of the last couple years.
Definitely.
And I think they're counting on that audience that was there for The Witch, that was there for It Follows, and Get Out probably as well, that they're intending for this movie to kind of follow in those footsteps. And it's certainly, I feel it's being marketed that way. If you've seen the trailers, we've got a lot of quotes coming out of Sundance and things mm-hmm. like that. So it's interesting because the trailers really give you a sense of the atmosphere and a sense of the basic setting, but they don't really hint much at the horror, I think, of what's in the movie. And having seen the movie, I can kind of see how and why they were doing that. But basic setup, you have Joel Edgerton, who I think is a pretty good actor. I think
he's good.
He's someone who's kind of been building his cred all along. He's always been good, but I find I enjoy him a lot more in some of these smaller films, all the way back to movies like The Square, Midnight Special, just recently. I find him more interesting there than when he's in something like Exodus, Gods and Kings, or whatever. but I like him. And we have him and his family, his wife, his son, and his father-in-law at the start of the movie. And it's clear that something has happened in the world, that there is I don't think it's a spoiler to say that there is some sort of illness mm-hmm. that is affecting people. And that's created a kind of almost post-apocalyptic scenario. Although, to be fair, we don't really see a lot of the world really mm-hmm. outside of this house and the woods directly around this house, which is an interesting choice. And it's probably not much of a spoiler to say that eventually Edgerton's family, who is holed up in this kind of really cool-looking house, you know, mm-hmm. that he's turned into a fortress, come up against or come in contact with another family who need his help, need his supplies, things like mm-hmm. that. And I think it would be safe to say that tensions grow
as two
families with both the desire to survive coming in contact with one another. And not always in the ways you expect. The tension doesn't always come from where you'd expect it to come from. Mm-hmm. And I'd say, Chris, is that probably a fair, without getting any kind of spoilers, a fair summation?
Absolutely. I think that's a really good setup for basically what the movie kind of is, without really giving anything away. I thought that they did a good job with one of my favorite parts about this movie was just the cinematography was really good. I thought that they had really good shots in the movie. It kind of kept things going even when the story itself was not, there wasn't a whole lot going on. Visually, there's always something interesting going on. So I thought that it was shot particularly well. Had a good moody score to it as well. How'd you feel about the score, Nathan? Are you like a good movie score?
I thought it was very good. What you said is correct. The atmosphere of the movie is fantastic. This mm-hmm. director also did a movie called Krisha. Have you guys seen Krisha?
I have not seen it.
I haven't seen it. I've heard of it, though.
It's a very interesting movie because it's about that one horror that none of us, anyone, they can't escape, which is family. And and it kind of takes place at like a holiday where everyone's got to be together. And it's not a quirky movie. It's funny because I feel like the horror in Krisha extends from kind of what it is like to deal with people that you feel should be on your side, but not always are. And the tensions there were in some ways even more interesting because Krisha didn't have this template of a horror movie, if you will. You know, you weren't sitting there expecting tension and horror, and these terrible things were just extending from the people in the scenario. And because the setting of Krisha is so mundane in a way, I feel like in lots of ways I was more like kind of put off by what was happening. You know, I wasn't expecting it in that setting. But this is definitely the horror movie setting. You get the score is very discordant sometimes. It almost harkens back to some of the Angelo Badalamenti stuff that he's done with David Lynch, you know, kind of a weird...
It really, yeah, sets the mood because, like, the whole time I'm watching the film, definitely have this, like, mood of disquiet. I was feeling very, there was something happening that wasn't right the whole time. Like, just the whole time I felt like a little doom and gloom kind of on the corners of the film.
And that's true of the cinematography, too. Like you said, a lot of this takes place in a house that is not really lit. You know, mm-hmm. in the evening particularly, everything is shadows, and you've got this one red door at the back of the house. And it's not, as the movie progresses, it's not as if there's some dark secret that no one knows hiding behind that red door, but it does become symbolic in a lot of ways, particularly for...
Yeah.
I think if there's a viewpoint that we're supposed to consider maybe more than the others, it's Edgerton's teenage son,
mm-hmm.
who you kind of see everything sort of from his eyes, mm-hmm. I would say, for the most part. And that door sort of has special significance for him. And there are moments where he goes into scenes I would basically say are kind of like dream sequences. Mm-hmm. But the movie's never very clear sometimes of whether you're in a dream sequence or you're in reality.
I think it's interesting that you mentioned that it is from his perspective. I think his perspective is going to be closest to the audience's. He's trying to understand the world around him, trying to get something out of it that we fully don't understand either. So I think that that was the right choice, kind of giving the movie that perspective to go from.
So all those things, those technical elements, make the film feel very creepy and uneasy. Even as the movie progresses and we are not seeing any sort of zombies or monsters or some dark force in the wilderness, you know, all these things we kind of think we're expecting because of the trailer, and kind of that there's some central mystery that we need to solve, in essence. And I'm not going to go into exactly where the movie goes, but I think it is fair and probably worthwhile to say that this, that the trailers and the advertising for this movie really are, maybe more so than movies like The Witch and It Follows, they're kind of misleading.
Very misleading.
This movie in some ways is more in the sci-fi drama end of things than it really is a horror film.
Definitely more of a thriller.
Yeah. There's a movie out that you can rent on VOD right now called The Survivalist. In a lot of ways, this movie has much more in common with that. The tone here is definitely pitched, I think, at a psychological horror kind of scenario. But the movie and the way it plays out is not the horror film. I think for those people, the people that went to It Follows and were like, I was so bored, or they went into The Witch and were disappointed, you know, right off the bat, these people might be doubly so disappointed by this movie.
Yeah.
I
got some things out of it, and I enjoyed it kind of for what it was, but I know a lot of people that are super excited about this movie, and they're going to be disappointed because they've been sold a very different movie than, I think, what they're really going to get delivered to them.
This movie has the feel of really like a short story, and I feel like it's maybe even too long in the hour and a half format. The tone I was getting, it's a little bit Ray Bradbury, a little bit, maybe a lot Joyce Carol Oates, and maybe a little Stephen King. But at the end of the day, I kind of agree, Chris, with what you're saying, in that I admire this movie, I think, more than I really liked it. It is a dark, it's a very kind of dour movie. The acting is excellent, and the tension is maintained through pretty much the whole movie. But there's a sense at some point where we see where some of these things are going, and we're expecting a little bit more. And the movie sort of, it's going somewhere, and I feel like it just draws back. And what it gives me ultimately, what it thematically offers me, is much less kind of than what I was expecting. Mm-hmm. And that's not just based off the trailers. It wasn't that I needed supernatural horror or anything like that. But in the terms that the movie establishes, it kind of, it hits general familiar beats human nature that we kind of already know. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, as human beings, we do tend to be self-preserving above all else. No matter how many Hallmark movies we watch and cry where the human spirit overcomes, human spirit still wants to save its own butt most of the time.
Yeah.
And there's that in there. As a parent, there were some tension-inducing moments, too, that kind of, they didn't take me out of the film. That's not the film's fault. But that I was hung up on some of those moments a little bit here or there. It's definitely worth seeing. If you are a horror fan, I think it's worth seeing. But I would say that you can probably lower your expectations is a good thing here. I feel like had this been a Hollywood movie, had this been a movie with a bigger budget and with different box office expectations on it, people might not be as effusive as they've been.
And I don't think it would be as good as what we ultimately get if that was the case, because, you know, when you have the smaller independent films, they tend to be a lot more focused on what they're making and have a better vision, I think, for it overall. It's interesting what you had previously told me about, like, if you had seen this on Netflix or something, that would probably be, like, one of the really good finds on Netflix.
Yeah, if you stumbled across this on Netflix, I'd never heard of it, said It Comes at Night, just like They Look Like People's a good example.
Yeah.
And turn this thing on and watch it, you'd probably be kind of blown away just because you'd be like, wow, there's a really high level of craft here. Mm-hmm. It's a movie that's haunting. There are images and thoughts and ideas in it that stick with you. And it really is about that kind of dread and paranoia that comes when the tricky part about dealing with people is that people always have their own agendas and their own wants, and the moment that those wants and agendas kind of crash up against yours, that's when things can get sticky. No matter how many fairy tales we tell each other, Mm-hmm. What happens when it's my family versus your family? And I think you get at the heart of the movie with that. Yeah. And I, it's great filmmaking. It's a strong movie. But I, you know, I walked out of it a little cold. I can't think of a better way to say it. And I feel almost a little like disappointed in myself for that. But I think that it isn't quite as effective as a movie like The Witch, mm-hmm. or even as It Follows on its own terms.
Right.
I think it's worth seeing. But I mean, honestly, I think back to a movie a few years ago like The Purge. Like, if this had been a bigger budget movie like that, I think people would be more quick to criticize it. And there are similarities between those two movies.
There honestly are.
Even in some people complain about The Purge not being fully realistic and not being quite as believable and a little generic. Some of those same accusations could be leveled at It Comes at Night, but they probably won't be, I think, largely because of the venue and the format mm-hmm. that it's in.
I agree.
So, Seth, I'd still say it's worthwhile. I think you'll enjoy it, but it's definitely being marketed different than the movie mm-hmm. we got. This is definitely a smaller scale kind of drama thriller.
And for like the real horror hounds that aren't into that as much, like that kind of a slow burn sort of horror movie, they may want to wait to like watch it on VOD or something.
Yeah.
It may not be worth a trip to the theater. I enjoyed it for what it was.
There's some people that like to escape with their horror. They enjoy mm-hmm. the kind of how horror is over the top or the supernatural or how mm-hmm. it's an escape. This is not an escape. This is pretty much face to face with human reality. And that's its strength. And in some ways, it's also its weakness.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd say it's worth watching. If you are a fan of independent films, if you're a fan specifically of independent horror, I think you should go out and see it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that brings us to The Mummy. I have to be careful not to say that The Mummy was better than It Comes at Night. Do you think we'll be able to do that?
I can honestly say that. I don't know about you.
Don't throw me under the bus.
I'm not.
Seth, you still with us?
Yep, I'm still here.
Just riveted, right? So you were excited for It Comes at Night. Are you excited for The Mummy?
I not so much.
You are exactly where I was about 24 hours ago.
I heard you, all of us. I heard you were preparing by watching Brendan Fraser videos.
Really depressing ones, too.
If it's as good as the Tales from the Dark Side movie mummy scene, then maybe I'll be in for a treat.
Oh, the Tales from the Dark... Now, the Tales from the Dark Side movie with Christian Slater, or the episode where they played strip poker with the mummy?
No.
You guys don't remember that one?
I don't remember that
I only remember the movie. I don't remember that story.
Tales from the Dark Side. Okay, they played strip poker
That's
with the mummy.
Just brilliant TV making right there.
Hey, 20 minutes in and out. Who cares?
Hey, you've got the DVD, so we can go throw it in a minute.
That's very true. So I think it was just this week. It's so funny that Universal sat on this to tell us that this is going to be called the Dark Universe, because they clearly had the logo all ready to go.
Yeah.
They were just probably thinking, man, we made a mistake, but we made it. So
let's roll with it.
Yeah. So when the logo comes up, you get the typical Universal logo, which honestly, I'd have been more thrilled if they had just gone with the old black and white Universal logo. You know?
They did that with Van Helsing.
That would be cool.
Well,
it's a warning sign.
Not so cool.
This is why we can't have nice things.
Yeah.
But it comes up in a kind of sepia tone, brown. Looked like when Gladiator came out. You remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then it comes across and says, The Dark Universe. I'm not buying this, the Dark Universe thing. I'm not even certain that it's going to last. And it doesn't... Why? If you're trying to cash in on Universal
like
Monsters,
yeah.
just call it the Universal Monsters Universe or something like that. I don't know. Maybe it's too many universes in one sentence.
They're just trying to jam into, like, Gorilla Girl movies. With this
Gorilla
like,
Girl?
Yeah. That was part of their old horror franchise. Were you not aware of this? They made 3 Gorilla Girl movies.
Do you have them on a box set?
No. And I've seen none of them. And the only reason I bring it up is I saw an article about it. And I was
Gorilla
like, what?
Girl. Seth, are you familiar with Gorilla Girl?
Were they directed by Russ Meyer?
You want a banana?
No.
Faster Gorilla Girl, kill.
That's awesome.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to derail things.
We can get to that, I'm sure, when we do our Universal Monster was... Who do you know who played Gorilla Girl?
I'm going to look it up on my phone right now.
I don't think anybody's clamoring for universal monsters, really. I mean, there's a subset of us who enjoy the old movies, but I don't think any of us really want or need updated versions of these films.
Well, since you bring that up, Seth, because I think that's a good point, who's clamoring for this stuff? It seems to me that the people that would want this wouldn't want this, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
A person that wants a universal monsters wants some form of their classic iconic monster, but I think they want a story that's rooted in the character of the monster. I don't think they're as concerned about who stars in the thing. I don't think they're as concerned about how many special effects are in it. They want to see a movie that treats the monster not just with respect, but with a little bit of fear and a little bit of awe and a little bit of pity too. I think they want the monster to be front and center. They don't care. They don't care if it's a action movie or a I don't think truly they want to see a movie that centers around the monster. And I mean, would that be about correct from your perspective?
Yeah, I don't know. For me personally, I don't feel.
You don't want it at all. No,
but like with this, it seems like they want it because they want to have this universe. They want to make it kind of in the vein of the Marvel movies and things like that. And like I don't want that. I don't want to end up having the movie where all the monsters get together and somebody has to battle. Shia LaBeouf comes to battle all the monsters against the dark universe.
Or they have to stop Shia LaBeouf, the ultimate evil in the universe.
I mean, we had a movie with all those monsters. It was called Monster Squad, and it was perfect.
You are so right about that, dude. That
and
is
Showtime did Penny Dreadful, so I'm not sure why we're still knocking on this door.
All right, I'm going to go. I'm gonna take a quick break back into Gorilla Girl for a second. Paula, the Gorilla Girl. So in 1943, they had the movie called Captive Wild Woman, where she appears. These all came out 1 year after each other. They made three of them. The one right after was called Jungle Woman in 1944, and 1945.
From a girl to a woman.
Yeah, 1945. We have the Jungle Captive, and yes, it was Paula the Gorilla Girl in
was the
these
actress?
Movies. No, I don't know what her name was, but that was the character, Paula the Ape Woman / Gorilla Girl. Yeah. What do you know?
I've definitely seen the poster for that, but I I've never seen that movie.
I think I need to hunt these things down.
Will they remake that?
No. But they should.
Jennifer Lawrence as Gorilla Girl.
One could hope.
Michael Bay's Jungle Captive Gorilla Girl with Megan Fox. Wow. So let's talk The Mummy.
Yes. Back to better territory.
I had zero interest really in this going in for kind of the same reason that Seth says. We had people, I think, who want to see the classic monsters. They kind of want to see them in the classic form. But it hasn't really always worked for Universal either, because I did not like the Wolfman movie that Joe Johnston made. I was really disappointed by that movie. And it was slavishly faithful in some ways, in other ways not. But as far as the design and everything went, what did you think of that one, Seth?
I didn't like it either. I did like the fact that they went for more of a gothic tone, because that's what I like about the Universal monsters, but it just didn't work for me at all.
Yeah.
And then, of course, like, Dracula Untold, throwing Dracula into, like, the swashbuckling fantasy realm, where he has a giant fist made of bats.
That's exactly the point in the trailer it lost me.
What? It wasn't a very good movie. Did you see that one?
No, I didn't see that
it's
one.
It's amazing
thank
you
God.
Avoided it. Van Helsing, I thought, could have been in the right hands, could have been a great sort of monster mash the same way Monster Squad was. But instead it was more like Monster Mush. It was like terrible. Yeah. I felt like actually offended watching that movie.
Weirdly, I know people who love that movie, but I hated it so much.
It's terrible.
Yeah.
I had a bad experience in the theater. I remember I was sitting next to this person who was taking the movie completely seriously. No, it wasn't my wife. And at one point I was laughing hysterically. A scene where Van Helsing is fighting like a werewolf on top of a carriage that is about to jump like a flaming ravine or something. And the carriage jumps it and all the horses jump right over it as if they're like Santa's reindeer. And I didn't know any other response than to laugh. I assume that's what the filmmakers wanted. And the guy punches me in the arm and he's like, "Shut up, it's not funny."
This is my livelihood.
But he was serious about it. He's like, "Oh,
you're terrible to watch a movie with. Oh, I'm sorry.
Did you guys see that? Did you see that Aaron Eckhart movie? Was it I?
Oh my goodness, Chris and
we paid money to see that.
You got screwed.
I think it was just because it was like the only thing out there, and it looked like the weirdest thing on the menu at the theater. So.
It was like January, and it was like, I don't. Why did we? There's no good reason.
We were bored. We just went to the movies. That's what it is. I have no excuse for it, Nathan. We paid money to see I, Frankenstein.
Yeah, man. Well, they don't screen it for me. It's a problem. Did you see it?
I did not. I've heard only horrible things about it, though.
Oh, you are lucky.
Even Bill Nye was bad. Like, he couldn't even redeem a single scene of it.
Not a single scene, yeah.
One of my problems with it, probably bigger than some of the other things in it, is that if you didn't see the title of the film come up, and you had just walked in this thing late or turned it on television, you literally would not know that Aaron Eckhart was Frankenstein's monster.
Yeah, you're just like, oh, hey, it's a...
You assume he's a guy with some few facial scars
that
decided to fight crime.
Who's this pretty boy who's had a rough life on the streets? Like,
yeah, it's like they're trying to make it like sexy Frankenstein.
Yeah.
I mean, they did
really did.
They did that too with that Gerard Butler Phantom of the Opera, where the only thing that was clearly like scarred were his windpipes because he couldn't sing. But like, I could just imagine some poor like acne teenager sitting there watching the movie and be like, I'm more hideous than Frankenstein.
Yeah.
And yet, isn't
it's Frankenstein and he's got abs?
The monster's part of the charm. I mean, isn't that like?
Yeah.
As a teenager, aren't you supposed to relate to like, you know, like, oh come on, yeah. I just got dumped, but at least she didn't want to kill me instead of be with me, kill herself and be with me. You know, the monsters always have it worse, except in these movies. So we get to the mummy, and the mummy, you know, calling this dark universe, and we're bringing back our universal monsters, makes you think that this movie is going to be sort of an adaptation, maybe, of the Boris Karloff movie, which is, I think, a great movie. But instead, it's really more a remake of the Brendan Fraser Mummy movie, wouldn't you say? I mean, it's updated to a modern era, but the tone, the feel, and all of the visual cues that it references, you know, the way a movie tries to pay homage to its previous movie, which in some ways, having Anaxaron and having Imhotep and all that, in the Brendan Fraser movie were the references to the Boris Karloff movie. But here, this movie doesn't even remotely reference Karloff or anything in those movies. It has the giant sandstorm with the human face in it, the same kind of storm that was in the 99 movie. And there's a scene where somebody hits somebody with a book from the library, and when it falls to the ground, it's the Book of the Dead that has that little...
straight from that.
Yeah, literally, it's the same book that had the place to put the little sundial,
the seal that they could twist it open with.
It up. So, Fraser doesn't make a cameo, thankfully, but it's that level. And really, the movie's it's got a lot more humor than I was expecting. It kind of plays that same kind of humor
in the
kind of goofy slapstick. I spoke about how, hey, one of the things I'd like to see if they're going to redo this universe is let's have an Abbott and Costello meet, you know, not Abbott and Costello, but let's do that. In a lot of ways, this Mummy movie is like the Abbott and Costello version in twofold. One, if you think about any of those Abbott and Costello movies, they're really taking the monster and jamming them into an already famous person's like shtick, you know?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So in that case, it's like, Abbott and Costello aren't wandering into a Universal monster movie. The monsters wander into an Abbott and Costello comedy movie. Everything the monsters are involved in involves Bud Abbott running around and screaming and, you know, and stuff like that.
Well, fighting over the same pretty girl and stuff
like that. Yeah, like the monster is in their movie. They're not in his. And that's really happening here on one level with the fact that the monsters are just wandered into a Tom Cruise action movie. And they're there while Cruise jumps over buildings and jumps through buses and jumps over flaming pits and swims around through, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Seth called it, it's Mummy Impossible in some ways. And with the mummy now is female mummy. So we have Sophia Boutella is the mummy. And I liked her. I thought that she, when she wasn't rotting CGI, I thought she brought a certain sense of gravitas to it. Not... a little bit better than Arnold Vosloo, who kind of looked like, Billy Zane on a Twinkie binge or something. But, but I thought she brought some sense of not poignancy, but she had a little bit of gravity to the character. Uh-huh. Not the same level that Karloff had. And the movie's not really based around her, you know? She's the mummy. She has a backstory that isn't that far from what was in the 99 mummy. Mm-hmm. And then she comes into the modern day. She's unearthed. We have Russell Crowe showing up around the edges here as a person who's discovered her. And if you've not watched any trailers at all, you might not know who he is yet. But
speaking of Twinkie Binge.
Twinkie Binge, yeah. We'll get back to that in a minute. Cruz is kind of playing a character that's not quite his usual sad, suave, got-it-all-together guy. He's a little more of like a bumbling fool in this movie, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, he's not the suave action hero. Like, he does that kind of stuff, but he's really not that type of character. He's really goofy and like he's a bumbling kind of...
His attitude in some ways isn't that far from the Abbott and Costello shtick, mm-hmm. which is weird. There are weird scenes in this movie. There's a scene where the mummy is getting ready to, for whatever reason, sacrifice him, and his head is pinned down to a table and pulls his shirt up and has got it. And of course, we get a whole nice view of his abs. And it's picking the knife up to stab him, and she's running her creepy mummy fingers over him. And as she's doing so, he just starts to laugh because she's tickling him. But it's not like the movie stops for like a weird comedy scene. It's just like he's giggling and she's like tickling him with her mummy fingers.
So bizarre. I couldn't help but laugh at that moment. It was so strange.
Like, what are you going for here?
At that point, like, the movie had kind of lost me up until that point, and that's when I started enjoying it.
That's a scene that would be in Abbott. You know, he would start getting tickled and he would, by accident, and he's laughing. And then there's later, you know, there's a scene where the other female characters kind of pouring her heart out to him and telling him, you know, because he's kind of a little bit like the War of the Worlds character, Tom Cruise, where he's kind of a disinterested, kind of a heel a little mm-hmm. bit, you know, and here's the room for him to become a better man. And she's saying, oh, well, I know there's a good man in there because you gave me the last parachute when the plane went down. And he just says, well, I thought there was another. I mean, this is the level that this movie is pitched at. And at a certain point, I think it just kind of broke me down a little bit because I was enjoying it. It's pitched at almost like a 12, 13-year-old level. And the zombie, I call them zombies because outside of Batella's mummy, the rest of the mummies kind of act like zombies.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of scurry around the London streets. And they're not quite as lithe as the ones, which I appreciate as the ones in the mummy, mm-hmm. the Brendan Fraser ones, where they're like leaping over double-decker buses and stuff. But they're creepy in their own right. Some of the action scenes are interesting, but it's also pulling from a lot of horror movies. It can't think far enough back to remember the old monster movies. There's a couple references. There is one neat scene where they kind of go into this, I don't know, what would you call it? Almost like a laboratory or den where mm-hmm. Crow is showing how he's been collecting all this monster paraphernalia or memorabilia, whatever you want to call it, and you see there's a like vampire head in a tank, and there's a
creature from the Black Lagoon's
little claws are in one of the bottles, and I swear I thought I saw the Tingler, but maybe I didn't, sitting in
you
one
probably
of the far,
did. Yeah.
far removed bottles over there. But for the most part, the other movies, it seems like it's referencing horror movies from like the 80s. There's a whole side story that really feels like the Griffin Dunn story from American Werewolf in London with the dead friend who is cursed and is constantly talking to Cruz and saying, hey, the only way to undo the curse is to do this. And he's all sort of gross looking mm-hmm. and undead. And it's like, hey, I know where you got that from. So there's even an underwater scene. Maybe this is too deep a cut for them to have referenced, but I felt like we're watching some Dario Argento's Inferno when he's swimming down into this like Templar crypt or something.
And that was not the only Inferno movie in that movie reference, because there was also another scene where like Cruz is getting swarmed by rats, and it reminded me of that scene
That's
in Inferno
true.
With the guy
and,
getting
shot. And I enjoyed a lot of this. The humor comes at weird, strange moments.
Yeah, that was the thing, the weird positioning of the humor.
The longer the movie goes, the crazier it gets. And it's, mm-hmm. it's at one point, it's just kind of going full out there. And it's fun, I think, as a kind of fun, goofy kids horror movie ride, which must be what they're trying to make here. I was mildly entertained by it.
Yeah, it was kind of an entertaining mess, and I think
I have to be honest and say I laughed. I kind of felt, you know, it was connecting at points with my 12-year-old self. I will say this. Back in the day, though, this thing would have been like a TV movie, you know?
Totally.
And
totally. Yeah.
They would have said, hey, let me go. In fact, I think, Seth, you remember that in like the late 90s they did a TV miniseries called House of Frankenstein?
Vaguely.
Yeah, I must be the only person that remembers that, probably for good reason. But it just feels like a TV movie would in the 80s or something, they would have said, you know what, this idea is too goofy to be a full-fledged like blockbuster movie. We're going to put it on television or something. And that might be where it ultimately should belong. I don't know that it's the start of this dark universe that they want, because it doesn't, to me, we'll talk about it a little bit, what we think that is, but it doesn't capture what a universal monster movie should be, not to me.
Yeah, not at all. It's a totally different kind of beast altogether, pardon the pun.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's definitely not what you consider a classic kind of horror movie, a classic monster movie.
So all I'm going to say is, if you're dead set on seeing it, and it doesn't sound like you are, Seth, I'm going to issue a brief spoiler warning here, because I do want to... It's not a big spoiler, because I think it's revealed pretty early in the movie who Russell Crowe is. Do you know who Russell Crowe is in this movie?
They've mentioned it in trailers, so it's okay.
No, I didn't recognize who was
it. You probably don't care.
No.
So he is Dr. Henry Jekyll.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Doesn't that just change your whole perspective?
Yeah.
Mind blown.
Yeah.
And they were saying, like, the connecting element is supposed to be, you know, Jekyll and his organization.
Yeah, so it's basically like League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. Jekyll
I was just going to say.
trying to stop evil, but he's going around and collecting the monsters and destroying them when he can. So he's chasing the mummy here to stop her from her nefarious plan, which I won't go into. And, of course, he still has the Hyde persona that he keeps down by shots. But the device that he gives his shots with is the most complex friggin' thing I've ever seen.
So it convoluted.
Like, I know. It looks like...
Because he has to keep inserting capsules into different points.
It's like a leatherworking kit or something. You see in the 80s of people want to make their own, like, belts.
It's messy. It's like... it's something that's going to take, like, 5 minutes to put together before you can actually use it.
It has, like, five rounds. And the Hyde thing just comes up on him suddenly. So he's got to open up his case, pull this thing out, fumble with it for 15 minutes while he's turning into a murderous killer. And he's like, he's got all this great security, and he's the biggest security risk. You would think a guy like that would just Skype his way to the big unveiling of the mummy and not actually show up.
So do they show him as Hyde in the movie?
They do. Yes. They missed a huge opportunity, given how Russell Crowe has kind of packed on the pounds.
He's fish-burned up nicely.
I wish they'd had him fall behind a desk, and when he got back up, I wish Hyde had been John Goodman. That would have been fun.
Oh, yes. That would have been awesome, dude. I would have loved that.
If he just jumped up and he was John Goodman.
Straight up John
British
Goodman.
British accent.
But yeah, they made him goofy, too. Like, they definitely took the weird... League of Extraordinary Gentlemen take with Hyde in that.
But they're playing it for laughs. Like, they're purposely... He talks like Ray Winstone. He's like, hey, buddy! And he gets up and he's... And I think they must have had him put in a line where he mocks how Cruise is younger, but that's not going to help him because Hyde's so much stronger. But in reality, Russell Crowe, pounds or not, is a year younger than Tom Cruise.
Yeah. I don't like any of what you just told me.
Well, it's weird because it's such a hot mess as you're watching this, but it's kind of to the level of it's so bad it's good to a certain extent.
Yeah.
Like
it's so bad it's okay.
Yeah, it's so bad it's okay. Like, I think over the past 24 hours since I've watched it, have softened on it a little bit, because I think initially going in, I was like, this is a remake of The Mummy. It looks awful. It looks like they've transformed The Mummy. Like, but watching this, it shocked me a little that it was not exactly that at all. And I think I've kind of gotten around to the point where I kind of enjoyed myself, I guess. You might be entertained by it a little bit, you know?
It's not that far off from the... What did you think about the Stephen Sommers Mummy, the first one?
I enjoyed it for what it was. I mean, it's goofy and, you know, silly, but it had some fun moments in it.
Yeah, and I think that in a lot of ways this movie is that same tone, but I'd say it's not even as good as that movie, really.
No, because it took so freaking long to get to the point where I was enjoying it as much.
Yeah, like, there's some really...
It took at least
dialogue.
A half an hour before I started even really engaging with the movie at all.
The Mummy movie from 99 had a couple things going for it. The period drama. I feel like we're at a point now. The Mummy from 99 was never considered a classic either. But, like, we're at a point now where I don't even think they would take the risk of making it. I mean, they did that with Wonder Woman. But, like, I don't think they would set this movie in the 30s now. You know what I mean? They wouldn't even go that far. And it was also the first time we'd seen Rachel Weisz. And I really like her in that movie. And even, like, Frasier was all right in that movie. I think everybody was kind of pulling their natural charisma. There's not a lot of charisma. I'm really tired of
literally
Cruise's shtick.
Cruise's love interest in that movie had no personality whatsoever.
No, you know what? It was almost giving me, and this is going to make Seth want to see it even more, it was actually giving me like flashbacks to that horrible actress that was in the Matthew Broderick Godzilla movie.
Oh yes, God. I remember her. I've seen that movie shamefully many, many times.
Yeah, let's not talk about that anymore. So...
I was, what you're telling me, though, this, like, bodes really poorly for what they're trying to build with this universe thing.
I can't because see if they're already making... They all would have to be in this tone.
Yeah. Yeah, they're not going to get... We're not going to get an R-rated monster movie. Not that we need to have one, but it's like, okay, we're just going to make... It's going to be jokey throughout this. Like, you know, if they're going for that tone with Hyde and, you know, Jekyll and Hyde, like, that just doesn't... bode well for the rest of the series.
That's exactly kind of the vibe I got off of it too. Like, they really have to make these things kind of goofy to keep the same tone, and that's not a monster movie to me at all.
Like, well, right, and I think we'll be able to talk about that. It doesn't have to be, like you said, it doesn't have to be R-rated. The original movies are very gentle in comparison to today.
Right.
They weren't for their time period. But, I mean, in a lot of ways, this movie, it's playing at about the same crowd. There's updates here, but the thing that bothers me a little bit is that they didn't try to update this tonally for today's audience. I mean, if you want to make a modern monster movie, you could do that, but that's not what they've done here. They haven't really modernized pretty much anything they're doing. It is as a kid's monster movie, I think it works okay. I mean, I just judging what's there, but it's a huge missed opportunity. It's clear that they aren't really taking this seriously
at all.
And it would be jarring if they did start to at this point. Mm-hmm.
I think I would have left the theater pissed if they were trying to take that seriously and gave us what they gave us.
I think the fact that there were a couple... I enjoyed myself for the most part. Some of the mummy designs were cool. I did like the female mummy as a character. Mm-hmm. Where the movie ends, though, it does bode poorly because it seems like all they want to do is ultimately create a staple of superheroes that have the powers of the Universal Monsters.
Yes. Yeah.
Which I think is a hugely wrong-headed compared to what the monsters are supposed to be.
And it's not... I really don't feel it's going to bring the boatloads of money that they think they're going to get.
Cruise's movies haven't quite been bringing in like that. And honestly, of his recent work, I didn't like this as much as... what was it called? One of its many titles. Was it Live, Die, Repeat? I kind of enjoyed that. I thought that was a pretty good movie.
Edge of Tomorrow, maybe?
Yeah, whatever. Tom Cruise dies over and over.
Was there a stinger at the end of this? Like, are they doing the Marvel thing with
this too? No, we sat through all the credits just to see, and there was nothing.
That's kind of surprising, because I know they did that recently with what was it, the Kong movie, Skull Island?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they did. Did you see that?
I have not seen that.
Well, worth your time.
That one. That was more what I would expect from a fun kind of goofy monster movie, and the Mummy is like if you're interested in all and kind of seeing it, if you did enjoy the Brendan Fraser Mummy movie, you might want to check this one out as a matinee. But it's someone who's like, you just don't want to put money in the Universal coffers for this dark universe, you feel free to skip it.
Yeah.
So we've talked about what a Universal Monsters movie shouldn't be. Seth, why don't you kick us off here? We'll talk about... First, the classic Universal Monsters, what do they mean to you? Because they mean a lot to me.
Yeah, the Universal Monsters are a huge part of my upbringing, and probably the reason that I really started getting into horror in the first place. You know, as a kid, I just kind of got the bug for being interested in monsters, you know, started with like things like Godzilla and stuff like that. But then, you know, my mom introduced me very early on. I was probably like 4, maybe younger, when I started watching some of these movies. But, you know, I was just obsessed with Ghostbusters and things like that, so obviously we're eventually going to get into the monsters. So I think the first one I had ever seen was Frankenstein, and then moving on to, you know, Dracula and the Mummy and Creature and everything like that. But there was just something about those movies that really, like, touched a nerve within me. You know, it's something about the way that they played with, you know, the shadows in it, that gothic, like, castle look in Dracula, just the way that the monsters were themselves, you know, that they weren't just evil creatures, that they had some kind of, like, pathos to them as well, too. You know, that just, it spoke to me in a way that, you know, really set me off to find more of these types of movies. And they have this special feel to it. I don't know, it like almost captures the feeling of what Halloween should be, you know, in a way. You know, it's there's sadness and scariness and
Satan.
You know, yeah, Satan, my dark lord. But but yeah, it's just something that, you know, it just feels, there's something that feels so right about these movies, like they just they feel timeless.
Absolutely. I agree 100%. They like every time you pop one in, you can't help but just like sit down and watch the entire thing. It's just like it enraptures you. It takes you back to that time when you were a kid and you first got your first taste of the monsters.
Yeah. Do you guys remember which of them were your first movies that you'd seen?
Which one touched me first? Now let me rephrase that.
I could tell you that oddly enough, the one that I started with was not an official monster movie. Like the first thing that I saw was Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. And then, of course, included Frankenstein, the Wolfman, Dracula, all these you know, classic monsters. And that was a goofy, fun little movie. But then after I saw that, I was like, Dad, we got to watch these. You know, we have to watch these old monster movies. They're great, you know. So I think my quest started about that time, probably like 10, looking for these old things and enjoying them when I saw them.
I think like you...
How about you, Nathan?
I think like you, Seth, my first experience was Frankenstein, the... first Boris Karloff Frankenstein movie, and I had the weird kind of horror upbringing where, because it was right around the time that VHSs were kind of coming into vogue, I was still up sometimes when my parents were watching some of these movies, so I probably saw stuff like Fright Night and Aliens before I actually saw Frankenstein. And one of the things that I think is kind of... interesting, and I don't know how many of us had this experience, I certainly did, that in the 80s you had these like shows like Elvira and stuff like that, where it was like the monsters were part of the movies that would get played like on a Saturday afternoon or a Saturday evening. And did you have any kind of horror hosts that you ever watched, Seth?
They didn't have anything local, but you know, I had seen like the Elvira stuff.
And I think Philly might have had, I don't know where it was broadcast out of, but down here we had, like, I've mentioned a couple times already, like, Channel 54. And I feel like that in the 80s, like, maybe mid to late 80s, there was a guy named Dr. Morgus who had, like, the crazy fright wig and whatnot, and he had an assistant named Chopsley. And he played most, but the interesting thing about his show was instead of playing the really, like, schlocky stuff, he would play the classic Universal movies. And I think he eventually, when he ran out of those, he made his way to the Hammer horror films.
Ah, nice.
Oh, okay.
So Frankenstein was the first one I saw, and I think Frankenstein is interesting because there's a, like, in some ways these movies, when they were made for adults as much as they were made for anybody else, and they were horrifying in a way, and seen as schlocky in a way, at that time frame, but they really do kind of, I mean, they really are good movies in a sense, I think, for kids. Not like a wholesome kids film, per se, but I think the kids, particularly as they start to get a little older, you can relate a little bit to monsters, particularly as you start to head into like your teenage years a little bit, where you don't feel quite at home in your body, and you feel maybe, when you have that first opportunity, the first time you go to school or something and someone just, you know, suddenly there's a group of people that don't want to be around you or you don't quite fit in. I mean, monsters sort of personify and embody that and extrapolate it to a point where it's like, well, again, man, they wouldn't let me sit at lunch. But at least they don't want to burn me down in a windmill, you know?
Yeah. Well, they also all feature, almost all feature some sort of transformation in them, well, you know, as well, too. So, you know, that would kind of fit in line with that changing as a teenager.
Right. It's like, oh, no, there's hair on my palms, but at least it's on the back of my hands, too.
I'm the wolf man.
Yes, what will I do?
Wolfman's got nards.
And now you've touched upon a true gem.
Yes, but Frankenstein was the first one. Bride of Frankenstein came shortly after. I think Bride of Frankenstein is a fantastic movie.
Oh,
and
it
a
is.
Better
yeah.
movie
oh,
than great, yeah. than Frankenstein. And James Whale, the director, I think those themes of like being ostracized and sort of being set apart, they do come out for a lot of obvious reasons. Whale, who
at the time, in the time period that he was making films in, was a closeted homosexual, a lot for work reasons, you know. And a lot of those themes, I think, definitely are coming out. Maybe not so much in Frankenstein, but certainly Bride of Frankenstein, I think, plays with that in what I would consider, by today's standards, probably relatively subtle ways.
Yeah. And that was in the 30s. I mean, that was like 1935.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, the way Karloff plays Frankenstein. Here's what I think is interesting, because I think if they did this today, we would be all over some of these movies. Karloff's Frankenstein's monster is a very different character than Mary Shelley's Frankenstein's monster.
Yes,
right.
He's not nearly quite as conflicted. He doesn't seem to be quite... Shelley's Frankenstein's monster becomes intelligent very quickly. So much to the point that I think it just drives him a little bit mad that he's so different. There's a kind of feeling with, at least the way Karloff plays him, that he isn't always completely aware of how different he really is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I find it hard to think of Shelley's Frankenstein accidentally throwing a little girl into the water. But it is such a poignant scene. He actually develops into a pretty much... He's tragic, but he's definitely a villain, I would say.
Absolutely.
In the Shelley's Frankenstein.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he starts to do some murderous things. It turns out he's really just being a human being, but I don't think that's really what they're going for with the Karloff.
No.
Yeah, it was very strangely divergent from that book.
But in some ways, he's a more poignant character. I don't necessarily like him better, but I feel like what they've done there opens up an aspect to the story that is very effective. It has affected tons and tons, not just versions of Frankenstein, but you can even see the ripples of Karloff's Frankenstein in movies like Blade Runner. You know, I feel like Blade Runner definitely is playing the Frankenstein card, but it's playing less Shelley's Frankenstein and more Karloff's, particularly when you get to Bride of Frankenstein. And I love what they do there, but Whale didn't want to make that movie at all, Bride of Frankenstein. And the studio was trying to court him to do it, and he really only did it so he could make a smaller movie of his own, get funding. But then he kept rejecting scripts because he really didn't want to make it. And then finally, which I think is maybe, that's maybe the key, he kept rejecting scripts, which was forcing people to try to become ambitious and think outside the box. Mm. And what are we going to do here? And they ultimately, in a way, go back to the original story and kind of bring in the bride. And I thought the way they did was just fantastic. Like the last, very last scene of the movie and the last line of the movie.
Yeah.
You know, again, we belong dead. Mm-hmm. I mean, no team's ever had it quite that bad.
Yeah.
What
do you think that's going to be the next Dark Universe movie is Bride of Frankenstein? What do you feel about that?
Javier Bardem is going to be Frankenstein's monster. I don't really feel much about it either way. I just don't. I don't know what they're going to do.
Again, all I can feel is apprehension until I see it. You know, really.
And there's not a lot of an issue to see it, I think, at this point. So,
what do you guys think? I just read this. What do you think of Dwayne The Rock Johnson being courted for the Wolfman?
Is that for real?
Yeah.
What?
Oh, man. You know what? They should just let him go make, like, Teen Wolf or something.
Yeah. Kevin Hart and Dwayne The Rock Johnson at Teen Wolf 3.
Oh, my gosh.
Just let him do it. I mean, like, yeah, like, let him make the Monster Squad. I mean, I don't want to see that really either, but, like, let's just leave. Here's the thing. And as we're talking about these movies, we can kind of move to some of the others. Dracula was actually, correct me if I'm wrong, Dracula was the first of the Universal Monster movies, right?
I think so, but like you, that was probably the Frankenstein was probably the first one that I actually saw.
So I think Todd Browning, who did Freaks, then went on to do Dracula.
Yeah. Well, there was actually, they did some before those, but they're not as, like, you got The Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Phantom of the Opera.
Phantom of the Opera.
Yeah, I guess those are technically the the Universal's got their name
but,
on
but
them.
But the hard
hit movies,
of the hard hitters.
Phantom of the Opera, I'm actually, that they put on the Blu-ray set was actually the Claude Rains one that's later. There's a lot more opera than Phantom in that one.
Oh, God.
It's an interesting movie.
But yeah, of the heavy hitters, Dracula was the first one.
Yeah, and the style, I think, that German expressionism that we kind of relate to some of those other movies that Whale used, that they used when they did The Wolfman, and is evident in The Invisible Man, and The Mummy, that style kind of, Browning kind of initiated that with Dracula. Mm-hmm. And Dracula really has all those weird expressionistic angles. It's probably the movie that has the most elements of that I've seen, except for something like The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, you know?
Right, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you like, what do you guys think about Dracula? Because to me, I like Bela Lugosi's take on Dracula. I would say this is a case where the divergence from the book is not as effective. I think that Dracula the book is a much stronger piece of work than Dracula the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I don't actually, like, as a movie, take the iconic elements away. I don't actually love it the way I love the Frankenstein movies.
Yeah.
It diverges a lot. Lugosi's performance is interesting, but it doesn't always fit with the story at large, I kind of feel like. What do you think about it, Seth? Right.
Yeah, I'm a fan of it. I think most of my thing is I really like Lugosi's performance. I love the way that the movie looks, but yeah, there's definitely some divergence from the book that I think, you know, could leave some room for improvement in the story itself. Like, I do enjoy, I don't know how you guys felt about it, but I've grown to appreciate the remake of it that, who did it? Was it Coppola who
yeah.
did it?
Mm-hmm.
Bram Stoker's Dracula, yeah.
Yeah, I think there's some good stuff in that movie, too, that kind of fits a little bit more towards the tone of the book. But I still like Dracula. I think, you know, it's just so iconic that, you know, it's hard to dismiss what's there.
Yeah, absolutely.
And most versions of the movie are very stylish. Like, mm-hmm. Dracula is a story that tends to be much more stylish. Even I think the stronger version is Nosferatu from the 20s.
Yeah.
That movie is still primarily style, you know? And have you guys ever watched it when they recently released it on the Blu-ray? It comes with a Philip Glass orchestra score.
I've not seen that version, cool. No.
Have you seen this, Seth?
No, I haven't seen that.
Really cool, because instead of having the kind of pieces of classical music that are in it, it uses this specifically... composed for the movie Philip Glass score that adds a whole new like kind of dimension to it. I mean, it's worth getting the Blu-ray or the DVD or whatever of the movie just to see it with that score. It adds a whole, for a movie that is so stylish, it adds a whole new like ambiance to it.
Yeah, I'll need to check that out.
So, yeah, Dracula, Frankenstein, I really love the Wolfman. How about you guys?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like the Wolfman a lot too.
I like the Wolfman, I'd say, more than Dracula.
Yeah, to me, the Wolfman is like kind of, if you gravitate towards one, I think Bride of Frankenstein is the best of all of them, personally.
I would agree with that.
But if I'm
going
to gravitate towards one, like, that was the first one I showed my kids, and I've probably shared, I don't think I've shared it on the podcast, but I remember that the first time they saw it with my son, it was probably the first horror movie that he doesn't watch many horror movies, but it was the first scary, spooky movie he had seen. I was a little concerned about how he would deal with, you know, the scenes where Chaney is, like, stalking people on the moors.
Yeah.
And he starts screaming loudly at one point, and it's a scene where Chaney, Larry Talbot has transformed into the Wolfman. He's now back laying in his bed, and there are the clear signs that he has been there because there's muddy paw prints coming into the house that slowly have transformed back into human feet. My son starts screaming, and he's like, he's all upset, and he wants to tell his mom because the Wolfman left muddy paw prints all over the carpet. And he's terrified by that idea. I'm like, geez, Jim, what? It's okay to be clean, but come on. But yeah, that's what stuck in his mind was the Wolfman committed the sin of leaving mud on the carpet. Meanwhile, there's like a dead gypsy out in the woods. But one of the things I love about that movie that I think they miss in the updated Wolfman from 2010, and this is kind of where Universal takes the wrong messages, the Larry Talbot in that movie is haunted and gloomy and conflicted, and the Larry Talbot in the Wolfman, the old film, he's a pretty cheerful, like, ladies' mm-hmm. man to begin with before the curse hits, and somehow that contrast of this affable, nice guy who's cursed by this thing, that's more interesting to me, you know? Than having him be gloomy and doomy, and this is a horror film. You know, in The Wolfman, when he is the Wolfman, that creature is always kind of villainous and scary. But Larry Talbot's a guy you wouldn't mind having a beer with as long as you got out of the bar before the moon came up, you know?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
I think the problem is that they try to pay so much homage to it that it becomes like a parody almost. You know what I mean? Not in the way that it's funny, but it's just like we're taking these, you know, themes to the nth degree to where, you know, it becomes like a hot topic show.
Yes, that's not wrong, because he's also got to have daddy issues, and he's this man-child that can't get out of his father's shadow. And yes, Talbot's father was a character and an integral part of the story, but I just feel that the strength of the monsters is that they were, in a sense, heroes of their own story, even when they were still the villain. Mm-hmm. You know, there were things... Frankenstein's monster doesn't understand who he is. The Wolfman doesn't want to be who he is. The creature from the Black Lagoon can't control what it is. And the mummy wants to get the girl. Dracula's got to suck blood, but he's at least going to be charming while he does it. they were the characters completely of their own story. In fact, a lot of times the hero, the quote-unquote heroes, which is interesting if you think in the 30s and 40s, the hero always represents the moral imperative, mm-hmm. you know? And sometimes almost like repressively so. Like, you know, the Van Helsing and Dr. Frankenstein, once he wants to destroy his creation, they kind of look like the man trying to keep you down a little bit.
Yeah.
They're these forces of the moral right that kind of come in, and they're not always heroes, and they usually end up doing great damage to the monsters in a way that doesn't seem particularly human. You know, mm-hmm. if you see where the creature from the Black Lagoon story goes, and it gets kind of weird, like, he's kind of completely undone because people just take him out of his environment. And what do you guys think about Creature from the Black Lagoon? I think its tone is different than the others, but I still like it.
Now,
yeah, I still like it, too.
I'm going to be honest here. I have not seen that one. I know you're looking at me with disgust right now.
I thought disgust, bewilderment.
You know I love things from the swamps.
We'll have to do that's a good double feature with I don't know, Jaws or something, right? Or
Zat. Swamp Thing.
Swamp Thing. No, a good pairing with Swamp Thing is Return of Swamp Thing.
It's Adrian Barbeau.
Adrian Barbeau. There you go.
And little pig demons and stuff. You know?
Oh my goodness. That's a cult movie.
Yeah, I like Creature. I think it's a good one. I've always loved the design of the creature. It's always been one of my favorite monsters. I don't know what it is about that design. It just looks great to me. But, yeah, it's definitely one of those ones that I don't think it's as popular as the rest of them, and it definitely does feel like it feels like it's coming out of a different place than the other monsters are.
Yeah, it is. Because it's not part of the... At the time that the creature comes out, we're starting to get, like, the 50s, like, giant bug movies and stuff a little bit.
Yeah.
Like, right at the cusp of that. And he's not, like, a... he's not gothic. He doesn't come from the gothic tradition mm-hmm. or the European, like, supernatural tradition. He's definitely, like, the lost world kind of monster in a swamp kind of deal. And he is a cool design. You know, and I've said this. If they have to do this series... If they're going to do Dark Universe, in some ways, and Seth, I don't know what you think, I feel like Creature from the Black Lagoon maybe should have been the one they would have started with, because I think they have the most latitude to make their own thing from that. You know, the creature design is iconic, but they could have gone a different direction. But you don't have an iconic actor tied to it, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
No one's going to be sitting there trying, like, he just walks around, you're not trying to mimic Karloff. You're not being compared to Karloff. You're not trying to mimic Lugosi or be compared to Lugosi. I feel like they could have gone... over the years, Carpenter wanted to do a version of Creature from the Black Lagoon. Like back around the time when the Langella Dracula came out, Carpenter wanted to do Creature from the Black Lagoon. Guillermo del Toro wanted to do Creature from the Black Lagoon. I just think that they could have done these movies... have done this one and maybe have done it in an interesting way, but I feel like now we've got this one right off the gate, you know. Mm-hmm. To me, I wouldn't mind seeing an interesting take on Creature from the Black Lagoon.
That's a very interesting perspective, and I actually think that makes a lot of sense. It's too bad they didn't go that direction. And sadly, they didn't pick Perry F. Caravella to be the creature because they wouldn't have to do too much in prosthetics. Just throw him in the water.
There you go. He got that in there. Good job. And I guess maybe we should talk about the mummy, right?
Organically.
Yeah.
The mummy's also really strong, and I find that that is probably one of the best balances of the creepiness that you want from the monster mm-hmm. movie while still being kind of its own movie. Like, it's not per se a horror movie. It has romance elements. It has the kind of adventure. Mm-hmm. Not adventure the same way the 99 Mummy does, but there's some mystery and intrigue to it. To me, it's a movie that can kind of stand alone as a whole and not necessarily be shoehorned into this is a horror picture.
Absolutely. I mean, like, the mummy himself is like a really sad, sympathetic character. So it feels more of a, almost at times, like a drama more than anything like weird or sinister. But I know it's not more adventurous than Abbott and Costello Meet the Mummy. That had so much adventure.
What's interesting is, like, so many of the actors, I think except for Lon Chaney Jr., that was like, dude, I'm up for anything, anytime. No matter what you make, I'll be there. Most of the characters, you know, by that point, everybody was... At one point, I think we have Wolfman versus Frankenstein, and isn't Lugosi Frankenstein's monster in that movie?
I think so.
He's in one of the... One of them is... He's the monster. And it's weird, too, because I realized the other night I was watching Young Frankenstein with my kids. It was such a great movie. And even that, even the comedy in that movie... It's not as wildly over the top as Naked Gun as you would think it would be with it being Mel Brooks. Even right. The comedy there is still sort of restrained. It's more restrained than in the new Mummy movie. But it's so funny how so much of what I think we relate to the Frankenstein mythology comes from Young Frankenstein. Like the Igor character. There was an Igor who was like an evil sort of guy who they tried to hang him and they couldn't hang him. And I think Boris Karloff played him in Son of Frankenstein, the third movie. In a lot of ways, Young Frankenstein's more riffing on that movie than anything else. But I think one of the issues is everything's so iconic now with these creatures that I don't think most of the time these people are even going back and watching the original film. They're going off of their memory of it.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
Yeah, and Young Frankenstein, I mean, like, that... If there's ever a love letter to those movies, it's Young Frankenstein.
I actually think Young Frankenstein's a better movie in a lot of ways than at least the first Frankenstein, maybe not Bride of Frankenstein. But so we know that we've got Javier Bardem is going to be Frankenstein's monster, and who knows who the bride is going to be. I mean, at this point, probably Charlize Theron or something. But
Scarlett Johansson or nobody.
I don't know. Do you even want... Now, a few years ago, they had a script for Bride of Frankenstein. It was some futuristic thing where she was just running around, like, mating with men or something.
What?
Like, that's species. Called Species. Yes.
Yeah.
That's not... Do you guys remember a Roger Corman movie called Frankenstein Unbound?
No.
Yes.
You saw this one, Seth?
Yeah, I've seen that.
It's weird. John Hurt is like a scientist from the future that creates some kind of climate device, but then it starts tearing a hole in the fabric of the universe or something, and he gets sucked back into time. He has to help Ra Julia, who's Dr. Frankenstein, with his monster who's gone amok.
What were you saying, Seth?
I said, do you also remember the Hennenlotter movie, Frankenhooker?
Oh, I was going to mention that one.
You try to take the high road, but we won't let you.
I actually like that movie. I like Hennenlotter stuff. It's really cheesy and
it's on like bad, Amazon Prime right now.
Oh yeah, let's not forget Andy Warhol's Frankenstein or Flesh for Frankenstein.
Oh yeah, Flesh for Frankenstein. Have you guys seen that movie?
No,
I've seen parts.
I've not seen that one.
I can't quite bring.
Yeah, it's not
to
good.
That's an interesting thing. Are there any good, like, Frankenstein movies that fall out? You know, actually...
Did Hammer have any good Frankenstein reports?
Oh, yeah. Hammer's movies are interesting in their own
way. I always assume they were more like Dracula, that kind of thing. They tend to have a lot of vampire movies.
We could do a whole episode on Hammer, I'm sure.
Yeah, most likely. Hammer is its own kind of thing. Let's talk about the one that we haven't mentioned, the primary one we probably haven't mentioned, which is The Invisible Man. Which I think gets missed a lot, but it's a pretty darn good movie.
It's a cool story, too.
It is, but it never really did much for me as a kid when I saw it. I was like, eh. So, he's not really a monster. He's just a man.
He's more monstrous. I mean, the character is more monstrous in a lot of ways than the other monsters. He's not as stylistically interesting, but he's one of the few truly... I mean, he's crazy, so that helps.
At the time that I saw it, I was not seeing it through those eyes.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying. You're right. So... Visually, the glasses and the bandage are a neat, cool image for a few minutes, but they're not like, there's Frankenstein's monster shambling around, or there's the Wolfman. Like, I agree. I think it's one that's maybe you kind of come to a little bit later. But I love it, and I thought the Claude Rains performance in that was really good, too.
Yeah. It's definitely more of an existential horror than just like a visceral horror, I'd say.
They really captured that well in The Hollow Man, the existential nature.
The Hollow Man is one of the most hollow movies I've ever seen.
But, the Invisible Man movie, I still think it's so weird that, like, when John Carpenter finally made an Invisible Man movie, it was Memoirs of an Invisible Man with Chevy Chase.
Yeah. I completely forgot about that movie.
That he actually made it, or that it existed, or both.
Yeah, that it existed.
Yeah, I think everyone, including Chevy Chase, has forgotten that it existed. But Invisible Man's a cool movie. That reason I bring it up, they cast Johnny Depp as the Invisible Man, or they're working on doing
that. Oh, so we're not going to be able to see him do his like weird little pirate stuff.
He'll find a way to work.
Yeah, you won't be able to see him dancing at all.
So. I read somebody who said, in response to the fact that Depp had been cast, is like, he's going to finally see the ultimate culmination and genesis of his career in the fact that Johnny Depp will finally only be playing a weird-looking hat.
That's great.
That's a brilliant observation.
So I want to run this down for you guys real quick here. So, you know, in talking about these movies, you know, we're also talking about this Dark Universe thing. I want to get your opinion on this. So this is pretty much what the schedule is looking like for the release of these movies. So first we have The Mummy. Next is Bride of Frankenstein. Then we get The Creature from the Black Lagoon. Then The Invisible Man. Then a Van Helsing film.
Ugh.
Then The Wolfman. Then Frankenstein. Then Dracula. And last but not least, we have Phantom of the Opera and followed up by The Hunchback of Notre Dame.
That blows my mind. Why would they finish it off with that?
I'm gonna go even more specific and say that blows.
Yeah.
I think they left them for last to see if this like franchise even works. Like,
yeah,
those will probably be the ones.
We'll just put them in there somewhere.
What's The Hunchback even gonna do in a modern setting? Like, I don't see that story working in a modern setting. They're gonna be like, you're a hunchback, okay?
Now, he'll just be the modern day creepy stalker guy who like
Paul Giamatti.
It'll be the hunchback in New York City. He'll be like, sanctuary, get a job, you bum.
Welcome to Trump's America.
Yeah, the sanctuary. Don't put me back over the wall.
That's just such a strange line. I guarantee you that they don't have it on here, but it's going to end with some kind of, you know, destroy all universal monsters.
Oh, it has to. It has to. You will see that if you watch the Mummy movie, the current Mummy film, that's definitely what they're trying to lead
that's
up to.
That's the tone. They're just going nuts, and it's like, and it's purely like black and white, good and evil. Mm-hmm. There's not any kind of pathos or any kind of nuance to it at all.
Mm-mm.
And where the
evil recognizes evil straight away, like it's ridiculous, like it just because for the sheer fact that it's evil.
It deals in completely generic terms. I feel like one of the things that is interesting about the Universal monsters is they are kind of psychologically rich, particularly for their time period. You know, you could sit here and have a discussion about what themes are bubbling underneath Frankenstein or the Invisible Man or even Creature from the Black Lagoon to a degree. And yet those movies in their time were still kind of like shock, jump out, mm-hmm. get you kind of movies. It's funny if you go back and you can find, particularly Variety, like logs all its reviews. So you can see some of the reviews by like Vincent Canby and people like that of like the original Frankenstein. They're talking about them in the same schlocky kind of derogatory terms we talk about horror movies today. But there was a charming character to them that just, I hate to be the person that bangs on that drum. And even to the extent that this movie was more relieving and that it wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be, it just doesn't have the character that it should.
Mm-hmm.
And if you are listening to this and for some reason haven't seen these movies, I think you should go out and see those movies.
It's well worth your time to search for them. Yeah.
And again, the Blu-ray set is probably not even all that much. You probably get for somewhere between $20 and $30 now. And it's got some great movies on it. And I think you get with that, you get The Wolfman, Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein, Dracula, and The Invisible Man, The Mummy, and Phantom of the Opera. And they're all really well worth your time. And Creature from Black Lagoon's on there, too. It's a shame that we want to just, instead of, that we want to churn out content without any real thought about how is it going to, you know, they had an opportunity here to redo their legacy. Here's what I think. Chris, you and I have talked about The Fly remake, mm-hmm. With Jeff Goldblum. To me, that was how you do a remake of a movie.
Oh, yeah.
If you wanted a template for how do I remake my Universal Monsters, I don't mean it has to be biologically horrifying and vomity, but The Fly is such a great movie, I think, on its own terms.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's how you should do the Universal Monsters. If you want to do them and be true to your legacy, do that.
Yeah, that's unfortunately not what we're going to get here. But I agree 100%. That's the way you go about it.
We don't need them to be all in the same universe. Just make it an independent, each one like an independent.
Because it is going to end up with like John C. Reilly and Will Ferrell hanging out with the Universal Monsters.
Yeah.
Key and Peele, meet
like
the
you
monsters.
Said, that's a great point. That's a great point. Like, because The Fly is, I think The Fly surpasses the original. Same thing goes with the Thing, which I think is, and it probably the best remake, one of the best remakes of all time.
Oh, definitely.
You know, to where it takes the story in a different direction. It fleshes it out even more, and it's
and I think
it's
the 80s was the time to do that sort of thing. I mean. There's a little too much sexy time for my taste, but like the Cat People remake, you know, it's a weirdo movie, but it's its own thing. It's definitely doing its
the
own
blob,
thing, trying to be original.
No, The Blob was a great remake. I love that.
The Blob. Well, did you guys, I mentioned already, but did you guys see the Frank Langella Dracula?
I don't think I've seen that one.
Yes, yeah. I like him as Dracula a lot.
It's a good movie, and Donald Pleasence as Van Helsing, I mean... It's pretty solid, and it's very beautiful, like, visually. It's a pretty good... I think it was just... It came out in a year we also had Werner Herzog redoing Nosferatu, and I think George Hamilton was like, love at first bite or something. So, probably people had their fill of vampires by the time that Langella Dracula came out. But it's a good movie. It's definitely worth seeing. It's better than the Jack Palance Dracula.
Oh, yeah, the ugliest man in Hollywood strikes again.
So, I mean, that's my thought is I'm just not. This movie was all right. I feel like this new branch of Universal Monsters is essentially going to be movies I can show my kids after I've showed them all the actual original Universal Monsters.
Yeah.
This is not.
Yeah.
It's Saturday morning cartoon version of those monsters.
Yeah, and it is kind of just it's name dropping. It's homaging. It's creatively, in every way, it's like they're out to lunch. You know what I mean? This is like your slack off sort of like, you know, this is, you might say, this is not your dad's Dracula. No, this is your stoner brother's Dracula. So, I don't know. You could take it for what it is, but and their previous attempts have not been very encouraging. Like, say, like the Langella version, but. I didn't care for Wolfman, didn't care for Dracula Untold, and I'm trying to think of what else they've tried. It's just not...
The Frankenstein reboot?
Well, there is an interesting Frankenstein movie that's out there that I thought was interesting. Bernard Rose, the director of Candyman, a couple years ago, 2015, did a modern-day version of Frankenstein, and Tony Todd even has a small role in it. It's pretty decent. You realize that they've hired almost like a boy band guy to play Frankenstein, and I'm like, I don't know where this is going, but the heart of the story is there. I enjoyed it. I'd recommend that. So it's Frankenstein, I think, from 2015, 2016. That's not to be confused with this Victor Frankenstein thing they did with with James McAvoy and Daniel Radcliffe. Did you guys see that at all?
No.
No.
We skipped out on the screening of that one, I think.
We did. I rented it from the library and watched it. It's a train wreck a little bit. It's not as bad as like Van Helsing, but it's just like there's so much talent and so much creative energy squandered on these things. I just don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny that you should mention Bernard Rose, because I think Candyman is a figure who could kind of fit in almost with the Universal Monsters. I think he's got a lot that's similar in style and just kind of the feeling of that. I don't know if you guys agree with that or not.
Slap him on in there.
Yeah.
No, I actually... That's a good point. I think Chris and I did an episode, was it like... It was Valentine's Day horror movies.
Yeah.
We found a way to get Candyman in there, despite the fact he dresses like a pimp. I think you're right, though, because he's a tragic figure. The way Todd played him, he was a little charming or at least seductive at points, and but he's also pretty creepy and pretty scary. I think that's a pretty good analog, I'd say, for what they were trying to do with the Universal Monsters. And there was a certain kind of scaled down element to Candyman where Do you like Candyman, Chris?
Yeah, I thought they were alright. It's not my favorite like franchise, but I enjoyed it.
I don't even.
I enjoyed the first
franchise.
One.
I always forget there are sequels.
Not very good ones. The first movie was pretty decent though.
Yeah, I just think of it as and we talk about Philip Glass, an awesome score for that movie.
Oh, that score is sick.
And you don't even think it's a horror movie. I was letting my sister listen. She's like, "It's beautiful," and I was like, "It's Candyman." She's like, "Oh God, get it away!"
So you do trick her all the time.
Yeah, I still do that. So I think that if you've taken that approach, that's the way to modernize it, where there are concerns of the time and everything going on. But I think we've had a pretty extensive conversation. You could talk about some of these movies forever. And again, the Mummy movie, it's all right. If you're looking for an action, there are going to be people that go to this expecting the mm-hmm. Tom Cruise action horror movie, and maybe they will be. They'll like enough of what they see that maybe they will go out. I doubt it, but maybe they will be able. If this turns people on to seeing the Universal Monster movies, good on them. But it's a missed opportunity.
And I think those are two totally different audiences.
They may be, but I mean, sometimes that's how you get to things. Mm-hmm. You think about, like, we've even talked about how one movie took you to another movie. Sometimes you're surprised what does that. And it's not like there aren't scenes in this movie that don't totally feel like some of the stuff you'd see in some of the Universal Monster movies. I don't want to be that uppity about it, but it's just a missed opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, everyone, take care. We will see you again later, and have a good night.
See you guys.